Hello and welcome to the March edition of the Organic Gardening Podcast. I'm Fiona Taylor and in a moment I'll be joined by my colleagues from Garden Organic, Chris Collins and Jules Duncan. March is a great time to get started in the garden. If you're new to gardening, now's the time to start sowing those seeds that will appreciate the longer hours of daylight but won't mind the cold. I'll be catching up with Chris about all this shortly. This month, I caught up with author, speaker and campaigner Tristram Stewart, an expert on the environmental and social impacts of food waste. The good news is that globally, food waste is declining. Tristram talks about how we can all play our part to keep this positive trend going. Later on, we'll be opening up the postbag and answering your questions on healthy houseplants, comfrey and what to do with it, and how to grow successfully in a bed that's been affected by raspberry blight. So, on that note, I'm off to join Chris in the potting shed. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Fiona. How are you?
I'm very, very well indeed. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very good. I'm excited.
I thought that you were going to say that. Go on then.
Yeah, seems so in time. So, and also all these sort of seeds are bought in. I've been planning it for a while. And so it's time to get going. It's all, all hands to deck.
Yeah.
Obviously, my long season crops, tomatoes, peppers, aubergines, they're all in the propagators. They're going in the propagators now. I like to get them up this time of year because then I can last long season. Means I'll crop heavily off them towards the end of the year.
So just to be clear, you've already sown your tomatoes, but it's not too late for everybody.
No, it's not at all. You can keep going all the way to the end of April with tomatoes. You'll just get more of a run-up if you start nice and early. Most gardeners prefer, quite a lot of gardeners will start them end of February, early March, those crops. I prefer to do it that. And because I sow in waves through different kinds of crops, they're kind of my first block. And it's a way of just keeping bit of order as well. Otherwise, I mean, I've just ordered quite a lot of seed. It'll just get a bit chaotic otherwise. So I tend to be quite uniformed in how I do it. Other things I'll be sowing, I like putting my parsnips into recycled toilet rolls.
Right.
Because they're very patchy germinators on a drill, which is when I put them on a line on the allotment. I only get two or three coming up, not so successful. But if I put them in a cell seed tray with toilet rolls sunk in with my compost, I get much better result. And as the parsnip grows, I can just pull that toilet roll out and plant it straight onto the
allotment. Okay. You see, now that's a revelation, because I've done the whole thing where I've taken a seed tray and I've lined up all my sort of 24 toilet rolls, and then it just all becomes a great big soggy mass because you're watering. But you've just explained to me, so you put them in individual cells.
Individual cells, And then also I'll have a drip tray and I'll water from beneath.
Yes.
So they come up by capillary action. But the toilet roll over time will start to, it's only cardboard.
Yeah.
But it just seems I get a much better take, a much better rate of part. It's one of my favourite vegetables. I love parsnips as well. And also, you're never short toilet rolls. In fact, I'm quite shocked at the amount of toilet rolls you produce when you start saving them. So that's another one, really. Also, I'm salad bars I'll start now. So I'll start doing my little salad bar in my trough on my balcony.
So that's not an indoor sowing?
No, that's straight in drills. I like to sow in drills. Carrots I'll start sowing as well. Drills for me is when I put a line down. So say if you're on the allotment, it's just the same for a big container. I'll put a couple of bits of bamboo, a string across, rake it, obviously, get it a little light fork, rake it so it's nice seed bedded, nice and tilthy. And then I'll use a dibber and make a small trench, and I'll sow directly into that trench. Cover them over with a sieve and tamp them, just like I would in a seed tray, but just doing it outdoors. I sow quite thickly, and I like to let them germinate, say carrots, for instance, and I thin them out. Remove your carrot, thin seedlings, by the way, because of carrot fly. But then I thin them out and let them grow in. I think you get a better start like that. And obviously, if they're in a drill, in a line, when the weeds start growing in March as well, you'll be able to tell what you've sown and what is been brought in by nature.
So that's your carrots and your parsnips. Potatoes?
Tatties, I'm going to go. This is where I start putting my tatties. Tatties play a dual role in my allotment, right? One, because I like to eat them, obviously. Who doesn't like a potato, right? But two, though, I use them as a weed suppressant in the more weedier parts of the allotment. So I'll put my earlies in now, maybe my second earlies quite soon as well. But I tend to dig quite a 30 centimetres deep, 30 centimetres wide. Okay, so quite a big trench. I then chip my potatoes separately, but then I'll plant them on the stagger. So I'll put one side of the trench, another one the other side, and then come up and down like that, almost in a diamond formation, if you like. And what happens is you get almost like planting a hedge. You get a really thick canopy come up, and that just keeps the weeds down. They actually have brilliant weed suppression. And that'll do that for quite a few months until I dig them up to eat later. So I kind of use them to cope with weedy parts of the allotment, and also because I love my mashed tatty.
Yeah, they're very good for breaking up the soil as well, aren't they?
They're great plants. They just are, and they just get on with it. I mean, I irrigate a little bit at the start with them, but then I cut the irrigation down. I want the plant to sort of stand on its own feet, if you like. I'm quite strict about that. When they're young, I water quite freely, and then I start to reduce the watering. And then they get on with it, really. Once the flowers start to appear and you start to get the yellowing of the leaves, I know they're ready for cropping then.
I mean, if you were a complete beginner then, and you're listening to us today talking about this, we've already picked three crops you can be cracking on with outside. So your carrots, your parsnips and your potatoes. I just want to recap on that. With the parsnips, growing them in the toilet rolls, you're doing that outside or inside?
Yes, outside. They go out onto the balcony.
Don't worry about that. You can get outside. Yeah. With your potatoes, then again, if you're a beginner, you know, you might hear people talking about chitting your potatoes, waiting for the little shoots to break through.
Yeah.
Is that something that needs to happen outside or inside?
I do that inside. I do that in my office, to be honest with you. But a garage is probably better because it's nice and cool. It's not too, you haven't got the heating on and stuff like that. And I just use old egg cans and I put the potatoes in that. Stick them on the windowsill in the office or in the garage, put them on the side. And if you leave potatoes too long in the fridge, they chip by themselves, don't they? Because you get those.
Where
the potato's got this overwhelming urge to grow, basically. But I just think you get some gardeners I know don't bother to chit. I just don't agree with that. I think you get a stronger, better plant if you chit them first and then plant them.
Right. Okay. So those are three outdoor crops. I'm quite keen this year to think about not overdoing it, not trying to grow too much, and actually seeing if I can really succeed at, say, you know, five or six crops, rather than kind of getting a little bit ahead of myself, which is what I do every year. And then, you know, you then have quite a, you know, large, or I do, I have kind of quite a large degree of failure because perhaps you were away for a bit of a time or something got away from you. And I'm thinking this year I'm going to go with four or five crops. So I'm hoping today to nail what those four or five are. So I'm interested in your salad bar as well, and you're cracking on with that. So that's an outdoor thing as well.
It is. You do that in a trough, or you could, I mean, I even do it in recycled tomato containers on a barbecue tray in the window, but I grow them as microgreens. But yeah, you just sow them in small, short drills in a big trough, and I get spring onion. I love a spring onion. I put those in, and obviously rocket, stuff like that. Rocket's really easy. Come with salad leaves. I like chard and radish seedlings. It tastes really nice as well. So anything like that. Well, you get a very bulk amount of seed in the packet.
You might as well use it.
Yeah, so, and also, I mean, it's all about chard. You might get like 300 seeds. So you could pretty much go through the whole summer re-sowing, you know, but I don't let the plants get too big. So it's a little bit beyond micro-cropping, then I re-sow or I inter-sow drills so I get a continuous supply. But certainly, once you feel that sun on your face mid-March, as we get into March and towards the end of March, you'll get that day where the birds will be tweeting and you'll get that sun on your face. That'll be the time I start salad barring.
All right, well, let's talk about that sun on your face, because of course it's, you know, it's different in all parts of the UK. It's different as to when you can genuinely get started, you know, and obviously you've mentioned, you know, these four or five really hardy crops, but they're not going to do any good if they don't germinate. So what do we need to be looking for if we're outside? What are the signs there that tell us now's the time to get going?
Well, there's a few things I use, really. Soil temperatures are really, really what's important. So I might look at when the grass is starting to grow in the park. Because that'll start to move above 5-6 degrees soil temperature. So that's quite a good indicator. Or you can use your thermometer and actually test the ground yourself in a way. And obviously things budding up, like at this time of year, you'll start to see the magnolia buds starting to swell. And so there's all those kind of little signs that nature's waking up. But obviously that doesn't apply to all crops. You won't be saying, sowing runner beans now, you know, even though there's a much warmer climate crop. But those sort of temper crops, carrots, salads, those sort of things, you can start to go, the grass starts to grow, the buds are starting to swell, you feel that sun. I would then look at that and go, yeah, I think that's ready, time to give it a go.
Right. Okay. So wherever you are, that's what you need to be looking for.
So if you're in Scotland, that'd probably be 3 or 4 weeks later than when I'm starting, because they're just, you know, the winters are longer and you wait for the daylight extension to go. So, which is another big crucial factor. So, yeah, the sun on your face might not happen until mid-April if you're in Aberdeen. I'm in a big city and it's obviously the climate's different. Yeah.
And of course, you know, the climate is changing and the seasons are changing and it's quite reassuring to know that actually, despite all that, as long as you're looking out for these key signs, you can kind of go by instinct almost, rather than worry about, well, hang on a minute, you know, it's April already, I should have sown. I mean, last year was a very interesting one, wasn't it? Because it was such a cold spring. And then you kind of went right round again really late in July. And unbelievably, you had this huge harvest.
Yes, it is. You are using your experience. I will say to people listening, if you're just starting out, don't be downhearted if you have a go. That's really, really important. It's about, I mean, seeds are not, they're a pretty frugal way to grow parts for a start. So, but you do, you try to read the weather. It's become a bit more tricky in recent times. You mentioned a cold spring last year, but actually the two springs before that were quite warm, and that caused me a different set of problems.
Yes.
So you're kind of playing by ear what you're doing, but there are significant changes like bud swell on trees and stuff where you know that nature's starting to go, well, the days are getting longer, the soil's getting warmer, and off I go. So with food growing, with edibles, it's a bit more tricky because they're quite demanding plants, you know. So just, yeah, you are part gardener, part weatherman, and it's all about observation. And if it goes down the first time, don't be shy to just start again. That's definitely a good rule.
And then in terms of what you want to start inside, so whether that's a windowsill or whether perhaps you've got a cold frame or an unheated greenhouse, you need to be thinking about your tomatoes and potentially your aubergines and your chilies. Is it too late for anything at this point? You know, we're in March. Is it too late for aubergines? Is it too late for chilies?
No, I think it's okay. I think anywhere, you know, up to, I think most gardeners prefer to sow them early, but you could go into April and probably sow those in, especially if you start them in a propagator. It just means you haven't got that longer, long-term crop. Cropping is if you start them early. So I do really well with aubergines and chilies and chilies. I'm a brilliant time with peppers. I do all right with tommies, because I think I start them nice and early and they establish as plants much earlier in the season. Obviously, I can't plant them out straight away. I need to protect them. I need to protect them until the frosts are over, but I tend to have a decent sized plant by the time they go into their final position.
Because that's the rub, isn't it? And I think, you know, if you do start your aubergines off, say, you know, in January, as some people do, you've then got another 6 to 8 weeks of yearning over this plant.
Yeah, even longer sometimes. You know, well, even longer. So you shouldn't put anything out that's tender till probably May, mid-May. No. So, well, true gardener will say end of, you know, first day of June. Yeah. And so you've got to really bear this in mind. I see a lot of stuff on social media. I'm sowing my stuff now, it's January. Remember that seedling's got to sit for a long time. Yep. And what tends to happen is because the light levels are low, it etiolates. You get leggy seedlings.
Yes.
They're never the same plant. Yeah. So you've really got to bear in mind that, you know, you want it when the day length is good, so they stay a squat, small little plant and don't start getting leggy and stretchy. So I don't rush forward too much. I tend to wait till I know the conditions are right.
Okay, that's really, really helpful. Yeah. So, and of course, it's March. There's still absolutely bags of time to sow.
We really are. It's a start. Don't panic. Definitely, you've got loads and loads of time.
Yeah. Is there anything on the kind of ornamental side that is good to be doing in March? You know, is it a good time to be dividing or you know, sharing plants with people, or how does it work in the ornamental garden?
Yes, certainly. Well, I'm certainly, well, hardy annuals, you know, my big thing. I'll be sowing those late March because they love a little cold snap to get going.
Yeah.
So your poppies and your cornflowers and your Californian poppies.
But your herbaceous, you know.
You can still lift and divide in March, no problem. Mm. You know, they'll be starting to bud up. You'll see the greener in them, but still you can lift and divide and replant if you wanted to propagate. That's not a problem. I'll still even things like, you know, pruning roses as long as they're not too broke, as long as there's too much leaf out, you can thin them out, train them to main stems. So there's still a lot you can be doing because plants are just coming out of dormancy. It's when you get to sort of March, April, and they're in full leaf or they're fully out, that's when it gets difficult.
Okay, yeah. So earlier in the month.
Yeah, so March is still winter in many ways, you know. I still consider it winter. I know we're sowing a bit and stuff, but yeah, you will get cold snaps and stuff, so plants will hang fire a little bit, definitely.
Yeah, okay. But your cold snaps aren't going to kill off things like carrots, parsnips, potatoes.
No, in fact, I think they benefit from it. Yeah. The only thing I've had with potatoes that could be a problem is if you get a cold wind. And that might burn the foliage a bit. But you know what? They'd shrug it off. They just produce it. But yeah, oh. it just kind of, you get checked. You know, you get knocked back if you get a cold easterly wind.
Mm. So tell us how it all feels down at the allotment at this time of year.
Well, it's interesting. I went down there. I mean, I did a big few days on it because I neglected it a little bit for a couple of months. I've been travelling, as you know, and whatnot. And I went down there and, you know, I forget how much I love it, to be honest with you. And I was down there and the birds were singing, and I've got an Irish neighbour, Peter, old boy, and we sit and have a chat and we put the Welsh to rights. So I'm quite enjoying that. That really goes on. But that just bird song, and then just seeing the soil, I fought the soil. I can't totally know dink because I've got areas of quite intensive weeds. So I tend to get a little bit of forking going, and I just love the sight of the soil. And then people start popping up you haven't seen for months.
Cause yes.
You know, they sort of people start to come back. There's a lot of Cypriot people on my allotment.
Oh,
okay,
fantastic.
So a lot of them in their 70s and 80s, quite old, and there's an old lady who works quite close to me, and she does the best figs every year. She
trips
it. But I'll stop and chat to her as well, and she has it's a bit sad story. She has a husband who's got a little bit of dementia, and she brings him down to the allotment site so he can potter around in the fresh air, and she does a little bit of gardening. And I think that kind of epitomises allotments in a way.
Community.
Yeah, well, I think it's just a little, that bit of escapism. That's what I felt about it when I was working. I've been down there for a while, and it's just this little, you climb inside this little world that seems very separate from the rest of the world, and it recharges you. That's a really good way to look at it, I think.
Yeah, I can imagine that, very much so. Do you have many newcomers? I mean, if somebody wants to get started on an allotment, how does that work?
Yeah, they come and they go. Well, I think the demographic is changing. There's a lot more middle class families on there. Traditionally, have been a working, it'd have been a cloth cut cap sort of site, I think. Because, that way they were given out and stuff. So you have got this demographic changing, which is great. I think the more diversity, the better, as far as I'm concerned. I think there is a little bit of an issue with people thinking it's a lot easier than it is.
Yes.
Because the big thing you need, the most important thing you could give me is time.
Yeah.
You need time for it. And I think, but in through the press and the programs we watch, it looks a bit easier than it is.
Yeah.
You know, and I think people come down, they've got a weedy allotment, and 3 months later, they're thinking, well, this is hard work. You've only got a Sunday to come down for a few hours.
Yeah.
And it gets away from them really quickly. They have this big purge on it, and then it gets away from them, and they get frustrated and they give up. My advice to those people is share the allotment, get two or three families. If it's really bad, build some easy raised beds, maybe, so you're not dealing with the weeds in the ground. Just have a little think about it. Don't, like you were saying, don't grow. You want to grow 5 or 6 crops this year because time is important. Just take on what you can do.
Yeah.
And then that way you won't get frustrated and you won't end up, you know, doing the worst thing you can do, and that's packing it in, because there's so much to be gained from it.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm just wondering about my 5 crops and whether you might be able to help me kind of choose. I know I definitely want to grow sweet corn because I love sweet corn, and I find it quite easy to grow.
Yes.
And I don't need to worry about it. I don't need to sow it till May. You know, I can crack on with that later. So that's one of the 5. Beyond that, I'm really kind of, should it be potatoes? I grew some potatoes this year. It was great. They're easy. And, you know, maybe that's another one if you want some success, because that's the thing. It's about wanting to have a sense of achievement and a success. But also the thing about potatoes is you can harvest them over weeks and weeks and weeks.
Yes, they keep,
so you just keep going. So I think that's as far as I've got.
Leafy greens, I think, for this time of year. Because you just re-sow those. So I'll sow those, like even radish and stuff like that. I'll sow them 8 weeks later, I crop them, then I re-sow them. Or even inter-sow them. I'll put them in drills and I'll... So you can get a pretty good constant supply. I've said this a lot of times. It's 152 quid for air freight, dried freeze stuff in the supermarket. It's all being grown hydroponically in Turkey or Holland. So in terms of your own carbon footprints, et cetera, and then don't taste the taste of anything either.
Yes.
It's very, very easy to grow leafy greens and chards and rockets. It's a simple thing to do.
Okay.
And you can get a supply of them. And also, I mean,
spinach in there? Put my spinach in there?
Spinach as well. Spinach. Perpetual spinach. So you can crop and come again. That's certainly spring onions, chard, rockets, all that sort of stuff. Very, very easy. Also, definitely, I mean, they need a bit of water to get them going, but runner beans and French climbing beans underplanted with dwarf French beans, so in tiers.
Okay.
That really, you can get, I think I get so much bean, and I grow them in tiers. So I grow them, the French bean is the ground cover, and then the French runner and the runner bean grow up bamboo, and I just get loads of crop.
So that would be a really good challenge for me, because where I go wrong with all the beans is I don't get my structure right at the beginning. So at this time of the year, I need to be getting that structure right. I honestly fine, Chris. I put all the canes in the ground or the hazel sticks in the ground or whatever. And, you know, a puff of wind seems to just blow them down. I just don't seem to have that kind of engineering brain.
Right, yeah.
That helps me with a structure that lasts. Have you got any tips?
Yeah, bamboo. You can't lose with bamboo. Yeah. So I would sink them. I sink them into like a teepee almost shape.
Yes.
Make sure they're sunk in the ground properly. And then I tie them with twine.
Okay.
And I tie them twine as where they meet at the top. And then I put twine round all the canes as well, around the bottom in layers. As long as you're pushing them in the ground properly, you tend to find I have problems with them towards the end of the summer, August, September, just because of the weight of the beans starts to pull them over.
Yeah.
But I think it's just maybe a bit of method is to make sure they're nice and solid when you put them in and put plenty of twine on to bind them all together.
Yeah, I like the idea of, you know, creating a bit of a spider's web of the twine going up, because that, again, I think that's probably something I've skimped on in the past.
Because otherwise you end up top heavy. The other thing you can do is where they all meet at the top is put a parallel piece of bamboo all along. If you've got a row of them,
three or four of them,
then tie that in as well, and that bonds the whole structure together. Then,
right, okay. Yeah. So then, if I've got my four wigwams, I've got them joined at the top, with a sort of parallel bamboos going through the middle at the top. So that takes care of my runners, my climbing French. So then, do I do my dwarfs just in between?
Yeah, I plant them as ground cover, basically.
Okay, there's no problem in having lots of different types of beans all in the same
space. No, I get absolutely brilliant results like that. And it cuts down the weeding, cuts down the watering. Just make them put a few stepping stones in so you can tread in the bed and you're away. Yeah.
Okay, there's going to be a whole bean feed.
I just love them. I just think they really are the plant that gives.
Yeah.
And I just like them as a food crop. I really like them as well. Yeah.
Okay. So what have I got? I've got my leafy greens, I've got my runner beans, I've decided on sweet corn and potatoes, and I've got one more. I think it might have to be parsnips, because I've never succeeded with parsnips.
Yes.
I want this thing to be the year.
I would do the toilet roll method into some cells and get them going at the end of March, mid to end of March. And I always put two seeds per toilet roll as well.
Yeah.
So I like to do that. And then I just think, put them out in a nice sunny spot and they germinate, and then you can transport them. And really, to me, of all the veg I eat, a fresh parsnip is just something else. On a Sunday roast, or if you're not inclined to eat meat, you know, anything like that, if you like your veg, they're just a bit fresh parsnips.
Yeah. So, well, this is all really good, isn't it? You're excited. You're going to sow your seeds. I'm feeling organised. I've got my five outdoor crops I'm going to really, really go for. I don't know. Maybe it's going to be a really good year. What do you reckon?
I think so. I always start the year like this. I'm sure I'll have a couple of defeats along the way. I mean, last year you mentioned was like, you know, it was a bit tricky, but that's all part of it. It's all part of it. I'll just think, no, the days start getting longer, the birds are singing. Let's go.
Now, Tristram Stewart is an award-winning author and campaigner known for his work finding ways to eliminate food waste. From making beer out of leftover bread to campaigning for us all to waste less food in the first place, Tristram also farms on the Sussex grasslands. I started our chat by asking him what he's been up to recently.
The thing that I'm most pleased about is that I now finally do add the word farmer to my list of employments. I live in the home I grew up in, but haven't really lived in since I was a kid, in the Ashdown Forest in Sussex. And I have a herd of cattle that do their primary role is conservation grazing on a nature reserve and five other land holdings in the surrounding area, where maintaining the heathland is the conservation priority. And we need the bovids for that task. And, you know, they are indigenous to this land. We first of all extinguished them and then brought them back as domestic species, but they've gone from this landscape and I brought them back. So they're more or less wild cattle, and the byproduct of that is beef. And it's started as a little hobby and has become the latest in a rolling iteration of businesses and other outfits that I've helped to set up over the years. What we're doing here is not using up land that could otherwise be left to wilderness. We are enhancing the wilderness and producing food from it. And that is the kind of win-win that I believe there are many, many opportunities for across these isles and indeed around the world, and fits in with my decades-long career of food waste. This is kind of land waste, as it were, and converting it into more wildlife and food is what we should do. I had this conversation with George Monbiot recently. He argues there that organic pasture-fed beef is probably the worst thing environmentally thing you can eat. And having written more or less the same thing in my books, I don't at all disagree with him, but I had a call with him about this subject. And I said, all of those arguments are true and none of them apply to my cattle. The things about land use and opportunity cost in particular. And he doesn't disagree. He just quite rightly points out that's not how we're going to feed the world.
This connects back beautifully to where you started, because if you were to say, well, that's great, you've got your cattle, you've got your beef that's produced from that cattle, but it's not enough to feed a large number of people. So, you know, you could argue that that's not the way forward for the whole of the UK. And yet we've got this juxtaposition about how much food is being wasted, which was where you started with this and kind of how you made your name, you know, some years back. So how do you connect those two? Actually, it's okay to produce less because we don't need as much. Is that an argument?
Well, the bottom line is that the food system as it stands is the single biggest negative impact that humans have on the planet. It's the main cause of deforestation, the single biggest source of carbon dioxide emissions, by far the biggest user of fresh water, the main cause of soil erosion. It is the main reason why we are in the middle of a mass species extinction event on planet Earth. The worst things that are happening are the extension of the agricultural frontier into the world's remaining forests and other wild places. Now, this is the number one thing, and it is being driven by an increase in demand for food globally, and that comes from rising populations to some extent, but even more so the shift towards a meat and dairy intensive diet and the maintaining of a very high level of meat and dairy consumption in rich countries, alongside the wasting of at least one third of the world's food supply. So given that we know that the food system by itself will cook the planet if we leave it to current trajectories of increased consumption and the environmental impact associated with that, when the Paris Climate Agreement was signed, it was calculated the food system would exceed that level by itself, even if we achieved a 100% transition to green energy today. And so something clearly has to be done. And the thing that cannot be done is what Cargill, Monsanto, and even venerable institutions like the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations are calling for, which is a 60, 70, even 100% increase in food production to stave off famine by 2050, when 10 billion people or whatever are expected on planet Earth. We already have a system that is causing unsustainable damage. So doubling it is clearly not going to solve any problem. It's going to actually undermine Earth's life systems and the food system as a whole. Fortunately, we don't have to do that. We waste at least a third of the world's food supply, and clearly reducing that, making more food available without producing another ounce of food, is a good place to start. Diet transition away from meat and dairy is the other massive gain. Now, coming back to my own practices in their small way, they are always designed to model the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is, how much meat and dairy products should we be eating? Well, the way to answer that question is look at the land available. What can we produce with all of the land that can't be used for cultivating fruit or whatever, all of the land that we don't need to set aside for habitat and wildlife? And let's grow meat environmentally friendly on that land. That means grazing animals on heathland, for example, sheep, cows, etc. It means taking all of the waste food that we are not as humans going to eat, all of the byproducts from our agricultural and food system, and feeding that to the monogastric species, the chickens and the pigs, and upcycling them back into food, which is why we domesticated pigs and chickens in the first place. Indeed, I believe they domesticated themselves. They came to us and ate in our trash heaps. And we developed a symbiotic relationship with them, which involved us preying on them occasionally. Those animals have their niche within our agroecological system. And the amount that we can produce from those sources is the amount that we should be eating, and no more. And that means much less than we do at the moment, but also happens to align with the interests of our health, because at the moment, meat and dairy consumption exceeds what is good for our health in rich countries. So, you know, I think that's how you work out how much meat and dairy production we can sustain and how much we should eat.
How does it fit in with import and export?
Well, it's all big red herring, isn't it? Because
yes,
ultimately, we can't import and export anything. If you look at it from the only sensible unit, which is that of the earth, all the other subdivisions, and in particular, the primary subdivision of the human species into nation states. We have to start looking beyond that. The nation state system, for all its virtues, it is my view, the single biggest and most nefarious block to solving planetary problems. We send our national governments off to international fora, whether it's the COP, whether it's the UN, whatever. They go the job description of fighting for the biggest slice of cake for us, the parochial interests of their populations. And that is inherently designed to create what has long been known and termed the tragedy of the commons. When you have a bunch of interested parties fighting over the commons, and the earth is a commons. The fact that we have colonized it and privatized it cannot get away from the fact that this is the quintessential commons. The ocean, the air, the atmosphere, the land, these are our common heritage. And at the moment, we fight over it like children for the biggest slice that our nation states can get. That is why every single international negotiation on climate change fails to achieve what the actual common good dictates must happen. How do we manage our land as a species, as one iteration of the abundance of life on Earth? That's the only question. If you were looking at ultimately, what is it that we're looking for? That's the objective. And then we need to look at how the nation states manifest that sort of more global perspective. So yes, maybe the Brazilians can be encouraged by the rest of us to keep a vastly greater portion of their landmass as rainforest, as forest, than we have in the United Kingdom. And let's pay for that. At the moment, we're paying them to destroy it, turning it into toilet paper and beef. And you know, that's how their incentive structure is currently working. Finance those activities and then wag our finger at them. That's not serving anyone's long-term interests.
Let's bring this to the individual gardener who has access to land, whether that's something they join in with in their community or whether that's their own garden or their own allotment. How do we get them? People do have some agency themselves to grow some of their own food, to reduce food waste, to do everything they can to maximize the resources that are available to them. Is that something you think about?
Yeah, absolutely. Every square yard of ground that we can grow our own vegetables on, ultimately, we can imagine subtracting from the net global demand for land use change, which is at the heart of what causes deforestation. So if I have a square meter of completely unproductive lawn and instead grow cabbages on it, I can imagine not having to take a square meter of fields growing cabbages. Fields being a global resource, doesn't matter whether they're in the United Kingdom or where, any demand for agricultural land contributes to the net total in the world.
Yes.
And the net total in the world drives deforestation. So absolutely, we can imagine any growing we do at home to be subtracting from that total and therefore contributing to, in a very small way, to solving the biggest environmental problem we face. That said, I don't think it's essential to get off on that in order to be motivated to grow in one's own food.
It
is a wonderful way of connecting to the soil, to the earth, and to life systems and our own bodies. You know, all of these things are really wonderful for our inner world as well as what goes on out there. And I think that's another good reason. But on an individual level, look, we don't have any problem identifying that if there is an old person trying to cross the road, it's a good thing to help them and not a good thing to mug them and take their wallet. Now, whether we do one or the other is going to have a negligible, non-existent impact on whether or not world peace is achieved. And yet we do it because it's the right thing to do here, now, with us and our immediate surroundings. And in the same way, growing some vegetables is not going to, in any significant way, cause the cessation of deforestation in the Amazon, but it's the right thing to do anyway. Ask the smallness of our individual actions, incommensurate as they are with the global problems that we face, nevertheless, it's the right thing to do the right thing, and it's going to make us feel.
I want to ask you more about composting and food waste, because it's going back a bit in your life, but you know, you famously gave a TED talk about it, and it's something that you would have thought it would have got better, not worse. And it feels like it's got worse. It's like environmental packaging and those things, you know, using less paper, all those things that seemed, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago to be the direction it was going in. And yet we seem to have come back round and the problem does not seem to be getting better? Am I being unnecessarily negative? Is the problem getting better or worse?
Thank you for asking that question. Well, I love to be a pessimist too. I'm very much temperamentally love to be with the darkness and the decay and the anger and the grief. And it's really important also as environmentalists to do the biomimicry, to do what nature does with death and decay. Ultimately, its purpose is to upcycle into celebration, joy, life, and all of the wonderful things that we really want to strive for. And the good news is that on the issue of food waste, we've got really good reason to celebrate. There are very few environmental initiatives around the world that can demonstrate as clear a measurable empirical improvement in public behavior and in, you know, corporate practice and government policy. On the issue of food waste, we can demonstrate there's been a very clear improvement. Indeed, since the forensic measurement of food waste in UK households began in 2008, per capita food waste has declined by more than 30%.
Has it really?
Which is a massive success story that very few people are actually aware of. Indeed, the government-funded organization themselves, RAP, often understate what this achievement entails, because people get mixed up with the more confusing information about, you know, obviously there's been population increase, so actually the level of food waste hasn't necessarily gone down as much. But you actually look at what people have managed to achieve. A third decline is not enough, but you find me something else like energy efficiency or miles driven or anything like that that adds up. And the reason why that's really important is then you're going to go, well, how did that success take place? How did a society galvanize itself to make that kind of behavior change on a mass level? And at the same time, it's my belief as an activist in this sphere, I have a vested interest in portraying it in this way. It's my belief that that grassroots reattachment to a deep value that I think we all carry, which is, you know, throwing away a third of the world's food is absolutely bonkers.
Yes, and we can't abhorrent. Have this. Absolutely, we can't
There's
have
something
this.
In our yeah. bodies that when we see a huge pile of food going to waste, then no, we're hungry people. We're chopping down forests. Why would we waste all of that food? There's something we know is wrong there. And people connected with that and managed to manifest that in their day-to-day shopping and eating behaviors. And having done so, they then held the corporations to account to align with their values. We are giving you money every day. Stop wasting food in this way. Give it to charity if there are charities that can use it. Don't impose on the farmers that carrots have to be as straight as a ruler. We don't need that to be this way. Don't make the Peruvians throw away hundreds of thousands of tons of oranges and bananas because they don't conform to the millimeter, you know, requirements that your size and you know, your beauty pageant. None of that is necessary. Don't, not in our name. And those businesses responded and changed their policies. And then our government representatives caught up with it and passed really significant legislation, like the Groceries Code Adjudicator Act, and in other countries, other food waste legislation. And that is how a system change took place. I see it as a grassroots movement. All of our laws ultimately reflect the moral attitudes of the population. And that can only be reflected if it's expressed. And I believe that the huge public upswelling of campaigning and outrage on the issue of food waste, which dates back to around, well, early 2000s and onwards in this country. Huge media storm around it. Wonderful organizations, including my own, the one that I founded, Feedback, and then hundreds of others around the world, thousands now, hundreds of thousands of people engaged on this issue. Celebrity chefs coming in with series after series, making it cool, sexy, and fun, and righteous. And we created a big change. Well, the reason why that's significant is not because we need to sort of, though it's nice, obviously, to recognize the different people and organizations that really helped to push that needle. You know, Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, Jamie Oliver, they all did their part. And that's really good to recognize it. But it's also really important because we have so many more battles like that to fight.
Yes.
And we need to fight them in ways that nourish us and are fun.
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, that's what we did with our Feedback's campaigns, Feeding the 5,000, Disco Soup, the pig I did, all about bringing together people around the joy of eating food. And just to finish off, that power that food has to connect people and connect people to the earth is, I believe, the most powerful asset we have for transforming the food system and indeed transforming the world system I have my favorite word is the word companion. Com is with and pan is bread. And humans around the world do companionship. They share food to build friendship. And that building movements around the sharing of food together has got such potency, such joy.
I've got to ask you, you must grow some of your own, do you?
Of course, yeah. I mean, my vegetable garden has fluctuated during lockdown. It quintupled in size. You can see it, you know, on Google Maps. If you look at my vegetable garden, it's gigantic. It's not as big now, partly owing to some life changes in which I no longer have quite so many mouths to feed living with me. But yeah, no, I obsess around that cycle that life has. Love growing fruit, got lots of fruit trees and chickens, cows, polytunnel, greenhouse.
Tell me about your compost bins.
I'm quite a lazy composter. I don't do anything. I just chuck all my organic waste in a big heap and it turns into compost. There's a lot of people around here who, you know, they're much better composters than I do. They really layer it up and get hot compost going. And I'm afraid I'm my father's son. My father, you know, started growing during the Dig for Victory, and I grew up with the incredible privilege of eating his abundant fresh vegetables. And he double dug and manured. I'm not a no digger. I do a little bit of that, but I still dig my pot. And my compost heap is, just a heap. I chuck everything on there. It turns into compost. Does it by itself.
You talked a bit earlier about the symbiotic relationship between chickens and pigs and human civilization as we were developing. It interests me now to think that we talk about food growing in a way as though it's something new. Listeners to this podcast obviously have been involved in growing their own food for, you know, significant parts of their lives. But I do feel that it's getting lost. And I'm interested in what you said about making it fun, getting people involved, showing people how straightforward composting is, how straightforward growing some of your own food is. And I wonder if you've got any reflections for our listeners on how we can involve as many people as possible, wider groups of people, younger people. Gardening is one of those things that it's sort of people kind of put it off to retirement. And yet there's so many reasons, as you've outlined, give it a go, give it a grow. Get stuck in. It does seem to then give us an opportunity to connect people back to the earth and those relationships with nature. I think what we're all trying to achieve now is connecting people back with the earth in whatever way and whatever opportunity they have available to them in their communities. And I wonder how we dispel that kind of, you must do it this way, and get people back with their hands in the earth and kind of feeling connected.
Well, I've recently been reading Joanna Macy's Active Hope book. I'm pleased to discover on doing so that I think I must have absorbed her message through the atmosphere. Of course, one can see all of these negative trends and take over the grocery supply chain by a small number of huge companies that have very limited interest in preserving either community or the health of the planet, and to get kind of weighed down by those trends and see that the dark forces aligned against us and all of that, all of which is not untrue, but we can miss the abundance of wonderful, heartwarming and connecting things that are really happening and that we are truly part of. I look about myself and yes, I live in East Sussex near the wonderful village of Forest Row, where so many wonderful things have happened over the last few decades of an alternative nature. This is everywhere, you know, just touching on what you've been talking about. This, I think about three different community veg growing outfits that have popped up in the last few years. We Grow Forest Row. This is an organization that's just in the last few years helped to create 22 food co-ops to get growing together around East Sussex, between 3 and 25 members, getting people growing food, but also connecting with each other. You know, it's just one of many. It's a community fridge collecting all the surplus food from the various different supermarkets. That kind of thing just didn't exist a few years ago.
Yeah.
And now there are dozens of volunteers. We've got our own community, you know, secondhand charity shop. It's everywhere you look. There's biodynamic farms popping up. There's such an abundance of wonderful organizations, groups, activities happening. It's actually becoming increasingly easy to tap in when you start looking. And if you live in an area, and of course there are still many areas where there are no such organizations, there are certainly other people yearning for that and taking that step out of the darkness into the light and saying, well, let's form a community group. And let's find an allotment patch somewhere or other, and organizations helping with that kind of initiative. It's so powerful. Most importantly, if you have got a pessimistic outlook, as I deep down truly have, we look at the trajectories globally, you'd be a bit mad to look at the way in which things are going in terms of the environment. You know,
yeah.
The fact is that the vast majority of species on planet Earth probably are going to go extinct by the end of the century, and probably some billions of people are going to have really extraordinary levels of suffering and deprivation of basic human needs. And those will be a result of us having failed to turn this Titanic around. But there's still a chance.
Yeah.
Even if it's 0.1% chance that we can prevent the worst of these outcomes from coming into being. And in a way, the smaller the percentage chance we have of success, the more energy, the more passion, the more people on their feet that we need, the more motivated we should be to engage with these solutions. And as I said earlier, if we can do it in a way that nourishes our souls, that is joyful, pleasurable, fun, connecting, all of these things which I believe every one of the 8 billion human hearts that beat on planet Earth yearned for more connection and more love with their fellow humans. And that is the capital asset that we have on our side, up against the bulldozers and the entrenched interests of vast corporations that want to mine the earth and turn it into cash. We have the beating human hearts that want exactly the kind of things that you're talking about. The living together, the growing together, the eating together, connecting with the soil and the earth and the natural cycles, and unlocking, it's more of an unleashing of that power that we're looking for. And when you start to look at it from that perspective, it feels almost inevitable that we will prevail. How can we not?
People who are listening to this and thinking, what can I do realistically? How can I make a difference? How can I jump in? What's your suggestion there?
Well, I think everyone has a different level on which they can respond to that question. And for some, it might be as small a thing as growing some herbs in a pot on a windowsill and connecting through that to the cycles of life, growth, death, decay, and then life again. Or it might be that they want to change their shopping habits and start giving money to a CSA rather than a supermarket. It might be that they want to go beyond that and engage with local organizations and volunteer their time towards a bigger picture of collective change. Or they may even want to change their entire career and go into organizations that strive for national or international change. And I think every one of those individual things that we can do, from the very smallest purchasing choices to the biggest life changes that we can create, they're all valid.
Time now for the postbag, and I'm here with two great experts, one known to our podcast listeners, Chris Collins, and also with us this time is Jules Duncan. She's one of our expert gardening team here at Garden Organic. So hello to you both. Lovely to see you. The first question, I have a number of houseplants which have recently put up new shoots. What should I be doing now to make sure they're as healthy as possible? And that came in from Chris. Thanks, Chris, for that question. Always good to be thinking of houseplants at this time of year. Just as we're not quite there with spring, but I always find that kind of indoor garden helps me get through. Don't know about you, Chris.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know how fond I am of houseplants. I have about 200 of them. So you think, well, if you've got shoots, well, Chris, you're doing something right.
Yes.
That's for sure. That's a good start to the new season that's ahead of us. I think it's doing the right thing. Well, I tend to, this time of year, I tend to pull all my houseplants out of where they're from, where they sit normally, and give them a good inspection, basically. I like growing them in groups, so I have a very, very foliated hallway where they all grow together. But over the winter, because you tend to take them for granted, you take your eye off the ball a little bit, I tend to water them much, much less. So I pull them all out, I put them in the kitchen, and I just give them a once-over. You'll tend to find there'll be dead leaves on there, dead bits of here. I might want to pinch out the tips, get them to bush a bit more. You might get dead cells around the edge of the leaf on plants like Clathia, which is quite common. You just take a pair of scissors and trim that off. They won't mind that too much. But I think we've got new shoots coming. I will definitely get a bit of compost, decent compost, peat-free compost, and top dress the pot. You tend to find that the soil tends to sink over time. So give them a top dress, Definitely give them a foliar feed, seaweed extract or comfrey if you wanted to, just to give them a boost to get them going as the new season approaches. And the other thing you might find is they bend to the light, to the window. You might want to rotate them a bit to straighten them up and get them towards the light. But certainly the time to show your houseplants some love, because they do get taken for granted, especially through the winter. And he seems like he's doing a good job, Chris. So, yeah, give him all a once over.
I would just like to say that I've still got a poinsettia that is still flowering. I'm really proud of that.
That's impressive. I don't have so many houseplants because I tend to be out in the garden so much. So I've got one shelf and I've put all of the houseplants on there because I'm inclined to forget to water them otherwise. So having them on one shelf where I can see them in the bathroom, so they get a bit of steam as well. A lot of them quite like that.
Yeah.
So I can see them in one go and remember to water them, which is quite, it's worked really well, actually.
Well, if you think most of them come from rainforests or tropical conditions, they're used to growing in communities. They like to be around each other. So I always go around to people's houses and they'll have like a cheese plant on top of the radiator on its own with all dead leaves. What's wrong with this? What do you think? You know, yes. It's neglected and you haven't watered it. You've got it near a heat source, a three big nose, really.
Yes.
So, mate, if you've got a cheese plant, why not get a bigger pot? Pick it over, it's not looking poor. Pot it up, put some underplant in. You know, put some persiers or something like that underneath. So, create a little community, a little forest in one pot. And you think they'll do better that way, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. All right. Okay, moving on. We've got a question about comfrey, our favourite plant. I'm growing comfrey to use as a plant feed. I don't really do anything to look after it, but recently I've read that I should be feeding the comfrey plant itself. Is this true? And if so, what would you recommend? Well, Jules, you're a big friend of comfrey, aren't you?
No, we've got the National Collection of Comfrey here. Anyone who's got comfrey will know it's quite a robust plant. Mm. They have really long tap roots. So if anyone has tried to dig one up, they will know that. And because they've got long roots, they can go down really deeply into the soil and they're picking up all the moisture and the nutrients that perhaps other plants couldn't. And so, no, I would say there's no need to worry about them. They look after themselves. It's a really good plant to use as a feed. And we make it in a couple of ways here just to demonstrate, because we're a demonstration garden. We put some in a bucket and put water on top to tear the leaves up. And that can be quite smelly and unpleasant.
Yes.
But we've also got just a little bit of drain pipe and we rip up the leaves and we post the leaves down them and we compress them with a weight. It's really, really high tech. It's just an old spice jar filled with grit, which weighs down the leaves and the rain comes down the pipe and it makes a very concentrated feed, which we then dilute. And because it's concentrated, it's not stagnant and we don't have that smell, which is a really good way of doing it. And it doesn't take up much space either.
Yeah.
So we decant it into a container and then we just dilute it when we need it. So it's not sitting there soaking up. But it's a really good feed, all-purpose feed, and we use it regularly in the garden, particularly soft fruits and things like that are really, really good to feed. But anything, really, we use it on anything and everything.
Yes, I was going to ask that. There's nothing you can't use it on.
No. It's just a really good all-purpose feed.
Yeah.
And obviously the Bocking 14 is really good. But if you've got any other types of comfrey, then you can use those leaves as well. Don't think you just have to use the Bocking 14. It's just that is the best creme de la creme. But then you can use any comfrey leaf.
Yeah. Bocking 14 was the variety that was bred and discovered, if you like, therefore, by our founding fathers here at Garden Organic when we were known as the Henry Doubleday Research Association. Chris, why is Bocking 14 particularly special? Everyone knows it as the best one. Why is that?
Well, Lawrence Hills was a very thorough man, I have to say, okay? And he was like typical of a gardener, really, of that, having that really curious nature. And he was around at the time where I think organics was looked on as a bit of hippy-dippy, you know, as a sort of height of chemical use and all this sort of thing. And he wanted to prove scientifically that organic fertilisers were a good thing. So he basically put loads and loads of different types of comfrey in a field and watched them and used them and found out which was the best one. So I think he was very, very thorough in finding out why Bocking 14 was the best comfrey to use.
And it was to do with the potassium levels?
Well, it's got a really high, over 20% potassium level in it. Also, the other thing you've got to remember about comfrey is it has this really deep taproot, as Jules mentioned. And the thing about that is it pulls up all these trace elements. Most fertilisers you buy in a garden centre, et cetera, will have NPK, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, very basic, maybe some magnesium, a bit of iron. But you get all these like boron and all these sort of trace elements, and the comfrey will pull them up into the leaves. So you've got this really, really rich fertiliser. It really is, right, the golden bullet, really, or the silver bullet, should it be, of the organic fertiliser world.
Yeah, okay, lovely. Thank you very much. Okay, moving on to a question from Damien. I have had to remove about 8 litres of raspberry canes because of blight. I now have a right-angled, southwest to southeast-facing narrow bed, which is sheltered by a tall wall, and I'm looking for something to grow in that bed. I know I can't grow raspberries or strawberries there again, but are there any other do-not-dos, given that there will be spores in the ground following the blight? So this is a really good question. Jules, what would you recommend in this situation?
First of all, I'd like to say, sorry, Damien, that's such a shame. It's really disappointing, isn't it? And you're right to say don't grow raspberries and strawberries there again because it will remain in the soil. Blight is a fungal disease, so it often crops up when there's a lack of air circulation or if the bed is very waterlogged. So think about improving the soil if it's very damp there. Preferably your own compost would be the best thing, but if that's not possible, then you can buy in bags of compost or have it delivered just to improve the structure, really, of the soil. I would also say no plums because they can be prone to it as well.
Okay.
And for anyone who's been lucky enough not to experience blight, what you'll see is the leaves will be starting, they'll turn brown and the plant dies quite quickly if it's got blight. So you have the leaves turning brown and then it follows its way down the raspberry cane and that starts to be blotchy and brown and the whole thing just becomes very brittle and dies. So it's so disappointing when you're looking forward to a crop. But it's a good area. You've got some shelter there with the wall and the southwest and southeast facing because you've got it on a right angle, I think Damien said. So you've got some options there, protection from the wall and also something to, you can attach something to the wall. So you could train a fanned apple up the wall. That would be good. Or even something a little bit more exotic, something like an apricot. Mm. But you would need to protect that from pests, particularly birds would be coming after it for the fruit. So perhaps check a bit of net over that. Or a pear would be nice along there as well.
All right. So that's sticking with the fruit theme. I mean, Chris, if you were going to go ornamental on that bed, what would you do?
Well, there's plenty of choices, to be honest with you, Fiona. Definitely. Certainly, you could have some stalwarts, hard plants, like Pyracantha would go on there, no problem. Hydrangea serrata, which is a climbing hydrangea, that would do all right. And you could go, maybe if you want a little bit more colour, clematis, something like that would do. Chinomeles, the Japanese quince would do all right. I'd probably underplant it as well, because you've got real sort of make a little ecosystem to get lots of colour and seasonal change in it. There's some good ones, or hookeras are an obvious one.
Yeah.
Loads of different choices with them. You could go for a classic, Lily of the Valley, Convallarius maybe, then do one of those. Bit of scent as well. Herbaceous geraniums. Bit of an unusual one is Cornus canadensis, which is a ground cover. And that, you always think of Cornus, you think of coloured wood and trees, but actually there's a herbaceous ground cover, perennial ground cover that works really well. Or if you don't want to fuss, Hypericum, Vinca, Periwinkle, we'll cover that ground, keep the weeds down, keep the watering down, and then your climbers will do the rest as well.
Okay, plenty of opportunity there to recover from the blight situation. So good luck with that, Damien. Let us know how you get on. The last question is from Zoe, and she's written to us from Carmarthenshire. I've been growing for many years, and I thought I knew what I was doing, but at a seed swap last month, I discovered my allotment neighbours all have different approaches to seed sowing. Can your experts give me their top do's and don'ts? Well, Zoe, you've come to the right place. I'm going to ask Chris, first of all, loves to talk about seed sowing.
I do. My favourite thing about gardening is growing stuff from seed. And as with that time of year, I am very, very excited. And that excitement, interestingly, never wanes. It happens every spring. I just spent quite a lot of my pocket money on seeds as well. So I'm ready to go. And it's interesting that she says that she sees other people with different methods, because there are. Gardeners tend to have their own sort of way of doing stuff. In fact, I think you learn it from the first person. And you take it through. So my seed sowing techniques are the same ones I learned as an apprentice in 1984, and I still use them. So basically my big thing is I've got two bits of kit that I really love to use. A tamper, I love the word tamper, which is basically, you can make one of these, a piece of wood for firming the soil. I use a sieve as well. So I want the sieve to create a really fine seed bed, compost bed, and then I'll sow my seed and I'll go with a sieve over the top as well, then gently tamp it down. So all that seed is touching the soil, the compost, and you get really even germination then.
Yeah. on both sides, the seeds touching on the underneath.
Yeah, on the top. And if I'm sowing in bulk, some people like to sell sow, but I like to sow and prick out because I think you get a stronger plant. So what I do is I do a thing called snaking the seed. So I'll start in the right hand corner, I'll go up and down and across. So you're kind of creating this wave of seed. And what that creates is they all germinate not too tight together, and that stops a thing called damping off, which is a fungus which rots your seedlings off at the base. So by spreading them out, you get reduced the chance of that happening. So definitely putting good, decent peat-free seed compost. Rule one, definitely don't skimp on your compost. Probably the most important thing you'll buy, to be fair.
Okay.
Yeah, and also, sieve over. So you've got nice crumbly soil. Then tamp, the nice gentle firm. Don't sow close together, and I reckon you'll be successful.
I think there's some controversy about how you water them as well, and everybody does it differently. But I think probably from underneath would be preferable. We don't always do that, but even within our small team, we have different sort of some preferences. So you'll find that, as you say, you do what you've learned, don't you?
You do, and also things have changed since using peat free. I water differently now than I used to before, because I think peat free, especially when their seedlings are up, if you've pricked them out, I like to water from the base. I think they do much better in a peat free if you let the water come up by capillary action, basically. Obviously, the other tip is just turn your rose upside down on the watering can, so you don't spray all your good work out, you don't wash all your good work out. But you're right, it's definitely, you have these little techniques, and it's an experience thing, isn't it, Jules? You do stuff and it works, and you just tend to do what you learned the first time, and then you alter the little game because there's changes like the type of compost we're using.
I'm quite a fan of modules, because I find when you are moving them on, it's easier if you can just put the one seed in the module. It's much easier when you're getting
when you're pricking out. I'm definitely old fashioned, I think, with the sowing quite thick and pricking out. I think the world's probably moved on a bit, to be honest with you, because people can sell so. And I think that also depends on room you've got, how much space you've got, and that sort of thing. But either or is good. Yeah.
And if you can stretch to really good quality organic seeds, I think that makes such a difference as well.
So you get a better plant, don't you? Certainly one, if it's edible, because that will taste better. Mm. And of course, the big golden rule we've all forgot, don't forget to label.
Absolutely. Oh, yes. Put the date on.
And I'll tell you the label. And I'll tell you what, if I've got 800 little plants in my front room, if I don't label them, I've not got a clue what's going on.
Yes. I do remember somebody saying to me quite recently in the last few years, from this very organisation, every pot has a label. Mm. Otherwise, it's hopeless.
And I think with the date, sometimes you can check when they were sown, and if they're not coming up for some problem, this problem with germination, then you know you can ditch it. You don't have to keep sort of looking after it and worrying about it. If it's gone, say, if you've got it hanging around for a month and nothing's happened, then...
It takes a guesswork out of it,
it
basically.
Does.
You know
it really
what you've
does.
Got there. Yeah. I mean, I'm certainly, you mentioned everything has to be labelled, I would have been shot at dawn by my foreman on the parks if I hadn't labelled anything.
It was a big one. But it's exciting, isn't it? It's exciting to think that we're all going to be starting to do this this month.
My favourite time, just propagation, I think, would be my favourite activity in the garden.
I just think that miracle of if you watch a science fiction film and they get into status, is it? When they get into like a tube and they wake up 60 years later and they get on a new planet. Well, seeds do that all the time. They're literally dormant. They get like 10% moisture content. They shut down and they wait for the right conditions. And then if you look at your allotment or your Brighton Gardens come August and you look at all that and you think, well, that all came from seed. I just find that... I'd never get my head around that.
It is miraculous. And when you look at the different, the variety you have in seeds, really tiny seeds up to big green seeds. And each of those seeds has everything in them that they need to grow.
Little DNA packaging. And they wait for the right conditions, they wait for the right stratification, the right time, and then it'll go. I can't get it. It's a bit like thinking about the universe. If you think about it too long, it hurts your head. It's such a miraculous thing, you know, and we get to play and do it at this time of year.
That's all we've got time for this month. Thanks so much to Chris and Jules and to Tristram Stewart. If you'd like to send in a question to our postbag, you can email podcast@gardenorganic.org.uk or message us on social media. We're at Garden Organic UK. I hope we've inspired you to get going with your seed sowing and to appreciate the first signs of spring. Thanks so much to Kevin MacLeod for the music. We'll see you next time.